So there's a couple things I'll share about that song. First of all, that image, that static image, that photograph, that is the backdrop, it's actually a photograph I took when we were out in the Pacific Northwest in Redwood National Forest. And the interesting story behind that is that we were driving down the coast in California and stopped at this really kind of neat moment in Redwood National Forest, which is actually very huge. And it was an early morning. It was foggy. The sun wasn't completely up yet. We pulled off the road at this trailhead, and we were the only ones around. And we got out of the car and started marching through this trail. And it was just absolutely beautiful. I had my camera. I had my tripod. And I kind of went off the path because I'm seeing the sun starting to come through and break through the trees. And so I kind of go off the path a ways and set up this tripod and this camera and take this photograph and, you know, do a couple of shots, obviously. And I feel like I get what I want. And they're gone. Long gone. And so I kind of figure out a way to make myself my way back to the trail. And then I find the road. And I don't know if we have parked north or south of where I've come back out on this road. I don't know if the car is above me or below me, and there's nobody to be found. And I look down the road, and it bends enough that I can't see far enough that direction to see if it's south. And north, I can't see far enough north to know if it's up there. So I have to make a guess. And literally, I'm not overusing the term literally, like, you know, these new generations do. I think it was like a mile and a half or 2 miles that I walked. And I'm getting brisk. I'm walking faster and faster and faster. And my heartbeat's going up because I'm like, I am now walking like a mile north, and the car could be south of where I came out. Fortunately, I ended up seeing this white van up in the distance and a bunch of young ladies just standing around it, you know, probably tapping their toes and twiddling their thumb. And I don't think I had my phone. I think that was the other part. I think the phone was in the van. So, anybody ever seen Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade? The opening scenes of that are Indiana Jones and his Boy Scout buddy, and they get into a cave area, and they leave the troop, and they go off on their own, and when they come out, the troop is just gone. And Indiana Jones' conclusion is, everybody's lost but us. It's kind of how I felt. I got out of this trailhead and I said, man, they're all lost but me. That song says that, God, you're as faithful as the sunshine, as the sunrise. And he says that your goodness lasts a lifetime. I know you'll never leave. That's at the core of what we're going to see this morning in our passage. Turn to Exodus chapter 17. What we're going to see at the core of our passage this morning is essentially more grumbling by the Israelites. But there's something interesting that we will see in our text. And that is that while they were grumbling about the lack of water, what Moses reveals is that ultimately their question was, is God even with us? And that song reminds us that God has said he is faithful as the sunrise and he will never leave us. And what a great promise we have. His promise to Israel was the same, but they needed to be reminded and they needed encouragement to know that that was the case. So I asked you to turn to Exodus chapter 17, and we're going to go through the entire chapter this morning. But before we do that, let's just do a quick little reminder. Let's look at Exodus 15, verse 22. If you recall, the last 2 weeks, Michael has taken us through two other examples of grumbling. Two other examples where Israel found themselves in need of something practical, something natural, and grumbled, not knowing if God was going to provide. And this morning we're going to see the third instance of that. In verse 22 of chapter 15, then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went out 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. If we jump down to 27, then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water, and they 70 palms, and they camped there beside the waters. God gave them potable water to drink, but they grumbled. Turn to chapter 16. Look at what they said in verse 3. They're out in the wilderness. They need something to eat. And in verse 3 it says, "And the sons of Israel said to them, to Moses and Aaron, 'Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread in the full, for you have brought us into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger.'" They need something to eat. And immediately, in their spirit, they cry out to Moses and Aaron. They grumble against Moses and Aaron. They say, "Couldn't we have just died in Egypt?" And Michael reminded us that how quickly they misunderstood and forgot what their time in Egypt was like, and what God delivered and what God rescued them from. How quickly do we do the same thing in our own lives? Wanting to return back to the things that God has delivered us from, thinking that it was so much better back there. We can be susceptible to the same kind of illusions that they were. "God, why did you bring us out here to die without food and water? Couldn't we have just stayed in Egypt where it was so much better?" And then we see in verse 7, where it says, "In the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your grumblings." In other words, you will know that he is with us. In verse 8, "For the Lord hears your grumblings, which with you grumble against him." Verse 9, "Come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumblings." Verse 10, "As they looked toward the wilderness, the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud." Verse 12, "I have heard the grumbling of the sons of Israel. You shall know that I am God." Shouldn't they have understood? Bitter water at Marah. God gives them sweet water to drink. Okay. No food. Grumble. God gives them quail and manna. And says, "I'm going to do this so that you will know that I'm with you. I'm going to do this so that you will see my glory." Should be done, right? Easy. Okay, we got two good examples that God is faithful. All right, no problem. We got it from here on out, right? Wrong. In chapter 17, we're going to see that they grumble a third time because they lack water. And so this morning, we're going to treat chapter 17 as two major sections, but they're going to be a little bit different. The first section this morning is we're going to see how God will demonstrate to Israel that he is still with them and he is still faithful. I said that at the core of our time this morning, the question that Israel was struggling with is God still with us? And we're going to see that in verse 7. But even though they grumbled about not having water, the core of their complaint was, is God still with us? And so God is going to give two demonstrations that he is still with them and he is still faithful. He's going to be their provider through water from the rock. And the second demonstration he's going to give is that he is going to be their defender by defeating Amalek. But the second section that we're going to spend some time looking at is how God is developing Moses as a leader. And we're going to see the hardship that comes with that. And hopefully maybe that's some truths that we can take away for our own selves. We're going to see how God is developing Moses as a leader, but it is not without hardship. So, As we get into chapter 17, let's look at verses 1 through 7. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Sound familiar? But I thought they were supposed to already know that God was with them. I thought God already covered this. Verse 4, so Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Oreb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he named the place Massa and Meribah, because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, here it is the Lord among us or not? So at face value, it feels a little bit like the grumbling is about the water. And at some level, it certainly is. But then Moses reveals in verse 7 there that at the core of their grumbling was a misunderstanding or misinformation or a lack of knowledge that God was still with them. Even after what God had already done the other two times that they grumbled, they were still struggling. You ever been there? How many of us have a long list of examples that God has shown up in our lives over and over again, and there are times where we still find ourselves questioning, what's going on? Where are you? Are you faithful? Are you going to show up? And so I said, what we'll see here with this question, is God with us or not? God is going to demonstrate that He is with them and He is faithful by giving them the water. So verse 1 says that they traveled just as the Lord had commanded them. Now, we've already learned and seen so far in our study of Exodus that God was leading them as a cloud by day and a pillar by night. And we learned throughout the fabric of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that when the cloud moved, Israel moved. When the cloud stayed camped, Israel stayed camped. They moved when God said move, and they stayed when God said stay. And so we see here that God has commanded them to travel, and so they have traveled. But it also says, in verse 1, that they traveled in stages. Isn't that interesting? They traveled in stages. And I think there might be some geographical significance to this. I did a little bit of research as best I could, and it appears like the distance between the wilderness of Sin and Rephidim is about 93 miles, I think. The region of Rephidim is guesstimated to be about 390 square miles. So as a comparison, the city of Columbus proper is about 220 square miles. Now remember what Michael revealed to us when they left Egypt? When they left Egypt, God could have taken them through the northern route up to the Promised Land. But God didn't. Because He said, though the Philistines are there, and if these people who are coming out of Egypt see these large people that are very militant, my people are likely to turn back. They're likely to go back to Egypt in fear. God knew the characteristics of His people. And so He took some on the southern route around. Now, when we go down through there, it's a more mountainous region. And so what I believe may have begun to happen was that because this region of Rephidim is becoming more and more mountainous and hilly with lots and lots of topography, it's entirely possible, this is speculation, but it's entirely possible that paths were narrowing down and it required Israel to travel in stages, in groups, as they navigated this path. 2 million people, maybe, can't all go through a valley as easily and as broadly as they may have in a big great plain. And so maybe what they had to do was travel in stages, in groups. The other reason I say this is because later on, we'll maybe get to this passage, later on Moses records that Amalek, which we will see in the second half of chapter 17, fought against Israel and attacked them because they were weary, they were worn out, and Moses also writes that there were some who were straggling behind. Now, again, speculation, but when we get to the second half of chapter 17 and we learn about Amalek attacking Israel, it may very well have been because they were traveling in stages and Israel may have appeared like low-hanging fruit, like an easy target, and going after the ones who were straggling behind, as Moses writes. We have to do this in our office. When we're designing buildings, we have to evaluate the number of occupants in a space, the number of occupants who have to exit and egress that space in a case of emergency, and we have to calculate how wide those exits and what's called the means of egress needs to be to accommodate that number of occupants. In other words, the means of egress system can't have these major, major choke points that cause a danger. Like on Black Friday. Like on Black Friday, when you see the crowds pressing their noses up against the glass to get that television that's been discounted. If there was a fire in here, for example, that door is an adequate width to allow all of us to escape. That door is an adequate width to allow all of us to escape. But when we get on down to those actual exits, those can't be smaller than what's required. And so I think maybe that's something of what's going on here as they travel. But then we see in verses 2 and 3, it says they grumbled about water, just like they had grumbled before. Verse 2 says, they quarreled with Moses, saying, give us water to drink. And Moses says, why do you quarrel with me? Verse 3 says, the people thirsted for water and grumbled against Moses. So in these two verses, we see references to grumbling and quarreling three times. It reminds me of the repetition that we saw in chapter 16, verses 8 and 9. Chapter 16, verses 8 and 9, and Moses said, this will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening. In the morning, for the Lord hears your grumblings, which you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumblings. Two verses there, and we see grumblings, 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 grumblings. Moses is driving home a point. He's driving home a point, and that is that they're grumbling, and God hears. We see the same thing here in verses 2 and 3 of chapter 17. The Lord hears the grumblings. Why do you grumble against me? And in verse 2, Moses reminds Israel, you're grumbling, trying to get an answer out of me, but do you know who you're really grumbling against? You're grumbling against God himself. Why do you test God? Moses says. You know, this is an important truth for us too. I'll be transparent for a second and just say, I really like to put a face to my complaints. I hear some rumblings, some grumblings. We're extremely prone to wanting to attach a face when we're frustrated. We want someone and something to grumble against. Matt knew I had a tough week. I don't know if it was this past week or the week before. And I was at the office really, really late. And he just said, you know, how are you doing? Great text. You know, just a great friend reaching out. And my text was, I want to throw something at someone. That's all I wrote back. That is how, and it was maybe 8 o'clock at night. Like, I just want to throw something at someone. That was the mood I was in. If you know me well enough, you know that government agencies often serve as that face that I want to grumble against. The thing is, my grumbling, even against government agencies, ultimately in my life as a believer, is a grumble against God. I am at some level in my heart not trusting the Lord to take care of this situation. That doesn't mean that these external entities are absolved or don't have any culpability in what they're doing. But that's not for me to determine. My responsibility is, God, I got a problem, and I have to believe that you're big enough to solve this problem for me. And to the degree which I choose to grumble against the government agency or whomever I'm in opposition with, tells God, I don't think you're big enough. Shoot. Dang. And Moses says, why do you quarrel with me? And he says, why do you test God? That's next level. That's not just, hey, you need to realize that I'm not your problem. You're not just grumbling against me, but you're actually grumbling against the Lord. He takes it next level and he says, you are testing God. You are testing the Lord when you grumble against him. You know, the word nasah here that is used clearly refers to trying to test something or to prove something. We learned in chapter 15, verse 25, that God used the hardship of the bitter water at Marah to test them in their faith. In chapter 16, verse 4, God used the instructions regarding the quail and manna. Remember, go gather just what you need for today. Don't grab more. Don't gather more. It's not going to last. That set of instructions was to test them in their faithfulness. Deuteronomy 8, 2, the Lord your God led you in the wilderness 40 years that he might humble you and test you to know what's in your heart. So in other words, what we see here oftentimes with the concept of test in this same word that's being used is God uses it to test our faithfulness. Michael shared with us and reminded us that James says that God will test us for the purpose of strengthening us, confirming our faith, growing us, building us, persevering, so that we might ultimately be perfect. But James says, but God doesn't tempt. He's testing for the purpose of refining you in your faith. He's not tempting you in ways that will cause you to sin. But the Bible is super clear about us testing God in return, right? Turn to Psalm chapter 78. Psalm 78 will begin in verse 13. Psalm 78, verse 13, he divided the sea and caused them to pass through. And he made the waters stand up like a heap. Then he led them with the cloud by day and the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths. He brought forth streams also from the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. Yet they still continued to sin against him, to rebel against the Most High in the desert. And in their heart they did what? They put God to the test by asking food according to their desire. Then they spoke against God. They said, can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rocks so that the waters gushed out and streams were overflowing. Can he give bread also? Will he provide meat for his people? Turn back to chapter 17. Moses is revealing that their hearts and their attitudes as they grumbled against Moses regarding the water was the equivalent to demanding that God prove himself faithful. Testing God, demanding, are you faithful or not? Psalm 78 tells us about all the things that we've seen so far in Exodus. And it said, they tested God in the wilderness. you know, the other thing we see now in verse 3. As we move on, they reiterated this bogus assertion that they were led out of Egypt just to die. But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" We saw that already in chapter 16, verses 3, and remember back in chapter 14, verse 11. I'll go ahead and look at that one for a second. Exodus chapter 14, verse 11. Then they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt?" This reiteration of this bogus claim that some way, shape, or form, God has delivered them, has drawn them, has enticed them, has led them out of Egypt just so that they might die in the wilderness. No. Far be it from God to do something like that. And so then we see in verses 5 through 7 that God gave Moses instructions to take the elders and go strike the rock. Verses 5 and 6, "Take some of the elders with you and take the staff and go up to Oreb and strike the rock." Notice the parallel this has to the signs and wonders God performed in Egypt. You know, many of the signs that were performed, many of the signs and wonders that God instructed Moses to do were done with both God's staff and were done with an audience of Pharaoh and oftentimes Pharaoh's officials. Isn't this an interesting parallel? Moses, I want you to take some of the elders with you. Remember that we talked about what the term elder means, literally the wise bearded ones. Take some of these wise bearded ones with you. I want you to pass before all of Israel. I want you to go up and I want you to strike this rock with the staff. He says, the same staff that you struck the Nile with and it turned to blood. The same staff that Pharaoh and Pharaoh's officials saw you stand with and saw my power displayed. The same staff that you threw on the ground, it turned into a serpent, and then I told you to go ahead and pick it up again. The same staff that swallowed up all of Pharaoh's officials' snakes. This staff that has been a physical representation of my power, my preeminence over the world I created, I want you to take that same staff and I want you to go up on that rock and I want you to do it in front of all of Israel. The same way that I told you, I want you to go before Pharaoh, I want you to pick up the ashes, and I want Pharaoh to see you throw these ashes into the air that will result in boils all over Egypt. The same way that I intended for my power to be displayed to those other audiences from whom I delivered you. Now I want you to do the same thing in front of my people. They're supposed to know, but for some reason, they don't. They are supposed to have recognized this after me making the bitter waters sweet, after me providing quail and manna, but for some reason, they don't. Now I want you to do this in front of them with this same staff. I love these parallels. Just like you struck the Nile. Now, that's the first demonstration that God gives that He is still faithful and He is still with Israel. When they are wondering, and what is at the core of their grumbling is God still with us? He says, yeah, I am. Watch this. Here's water for you to drink. From a rock. The second demonstration is going to be the second half of chapter 17. Look at verse 8. And Moses said, yep. Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. I hinted at this earlier. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out. Fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses and Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Just as they said. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. So here we see what I'll call the second demonstration that God gives that he is still with Israel and that he is still faithful. Amalek was the grandson of Esau. You might remember when we walked through Genesis that we saw that Esau took wives from the daughters of Canaan, whereas Jacob got Rachel and Leah from their own family. And Esau's decision to go take wives from Canaan, from the Canaanites, it frustrated Isaac and Rebekah. Do you remember that? It brought them frustration and hardship and heartburn. Genesis 26:34 says, Esau's wives brought about grief to Isaac and Rebekah. But then you might remember what happened between Jacob and Esau. There was a division. There was a parting. There was a separation. Jacob was a little creative, calculated, stole the blessing and the birthright. And that created division and some animosity between those two. But we also saw later in Genesis that Jacob and Esau had a reunion. That Jacob and Esau came together, we'll say made amends. We don't know to what degree and we don't know what that looked like going forward. But there was a reconciliation between the two of them. Yet, the descendants of Jacob and the descendants of Esau will forever be in contention. Even if Jacob and Esau themselves were reconciled, the descendants still had a beef, still had an issue with Esau and Jacob. And so we see here that Amalek, these are the Amalekites. The Amalekites are living in the region. They're somewhat nomadic. The Amalekites, as descendants of Esau, still have a beef with the descendants of Jacob. They still are going to take issue with Jacob's descendants migrating back to the land. They're still frustrated about what happened to their forefather Esau, who was cheated out of his birthright in their eyes and the blessing. And so here we see that Israel is going to have a lot of opposition going forward. They're going to have a lot of opposition when they go into the land that God is going to give them. But God has promised, I'll take care of it as long as you obey and do what you say. But we see here the first instance of Israel seeking opposition here. And it's by the Amalekites. And as I said before, I don't know if the geographical circumstances and topography led them to want to attack, but it appears to be unprovoked. In Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 through 19, Moses writes that Amalek attacked Israel when they were weary and worn out. They met Israel along their journey and attacked all who were lagging behind. And Moses says that they had no fear of God. The Amalekites actually had no fear of God. And so Moses says to Joshua, choose men who are worthy of defending Israel and go against the Amalekites. And Moses and Aaron and Hur, they go up the mountain and they take the staff of God. And once again, we see this sort of pivotal role that the staff plays. We had joked about Michael doing this message and either Matt and I or Nate and I coming up here and just holding up Michael's hands for the whole message. Can you imagine though? Can you imagine how weary Moses must have grown trying to hold his hands up? Trying to hold his hands up and stand for the duration of this battle, this contest between Israel and the Amalekites. And as he lowers his hands and as he gets weary and as he gets worn out, the Amalekites begin to prevail. But as he lifts his hands up and stands, Israel prevails. And so they set a stone under Moses so he could sit. And they come over and each one holds up his hands. And they do so until sunset and Israel prevails. Not because of Israel's strength, not because of Moses' strength, because God is faithful. And God promised his people that he would be faithful to them. And so we see that God has been their provider in the water, and now God has been their defender. Two examples, two demonstrations. You want to know if I'm still with you? Yes, I'm still with you. Here's water, and here's a victory over your enemies. And so the immediate issue was the water, but the core issue was, is God still with us? You know, their physical, practical need was water, but they needed that spiritual understanding. Isn't that a little bit like Jesus when he met the woman at the well? She's coming for water, a very practical, physical need. And Jesus meets her right where she's at, but he addresses the spiritual. You need a peace that comes from the wellspring that I am, that you're not going to find anywhere else. This water in the ground from this well is going to satisfy your thirst, but I know that you're thirsting for more. I know that life is incomplete, and I know that what you really need is to never thirst again spiritually. That's what Jesus has done for us. He's our everlasting spring that we should never spiritually thirst again. And we have a peace. So God demonstrates twice that he's still with them. Now, the second half that I want to spend some time here is that there are a couple of things I think chapter 17 reveals to us that have some slight nuances and differences than things that we've seen before. And there's maybe three that I'll spend some time on. What we saw in verse 4 is unique and maybe unlike what we've seen in our passages so far as I can tell. Verse 4 says, Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me." Did you catch that when we read that? That's significantly more amplified than just quarreling and grumbling. Moses has determined that the anger of God's people is such that they may actually be ready to stone him. And I think that's a little bit of a nuance and a new development that we're seeing here in this text. The second is that we see Moses being surrounded by Aaron, Hur, Joshua, and the elders. More or less, to date, we've seen Moses and occasionally Aaron. But now we see Moses surrounded by Hur, Joshua, and the elders. And then we see a third thing that God instructs Moses, which is to specifically memorialize what God has done. Similar to the manna to be put in the Ark of the Covenant. But God gives Moses specific instructions. I want you to memorialize, I want you to write down what I have done here. And so the reason I'm spending some time on these as we kind of close our service is because I believe what we're seeing here is God continuing to develop Moses as a leader. And we will eventually see in 2 weeks in chapter 18 that God is going to help Moses in his leadership development by instructing him and showing him how he can delegate. And so for us this morning, does not God call each one of us to be leaders in our own spheres of influence? We're to be leaders in the workplace among the people who are in our sphere of influence. We are to be leaders in our schools, leaders in our ministries, leaders in our homes. You may not see yourself or believe that you're called to leadership in a conventional sense, but you know what? God wants you to be a leader as you walk through this world and as you have influence over those around you. And so there's four things that I want to kind of highlight for us this morning from what we're seeing in Moses. The first is that as God's leader, Moses will be the object of the people's anger and frustration. We've already seen that in verses 2, 3, and 4. As God's leader, Moses will be the object of the people's anger and frustration. And so I said that verse 4 gives us a little bit more insight. They were so mad, so frustrated, they had in mind to stone him, or at least Moses understood or interpreted their anger to be available or able to stone him if they didn't get what they wanted. And I can only imagine that Moses was probably giving them answers like, be patient, right? The Lord is faithful. The Lord is good. All of these truths that were extremely true, they were the right answers. They were the answers that Moses should be giving, but they didn't satisfy Israel. Have you ever been there? Have you ever given the right answers, the right responses, biblical truths, but it didn't satisfy somebody's anger? In that moment, that wasn't enough for them. Now, you did everything you were called to, but you were still the object of their wrath. You were still the face of their opposition. You know that you're not their problem. They have a problem with God. But as far as they're concerned, you're their obstacle. And the biblical truths that you're espousing to them, as true as they may be, they're not landing. They're not resonating. And so, one of the things that we can see here and take away for ourselves is that when God is developing us in leadership roles, it's often going to mean that we're the object of people's anger. You happy where this is going? Oftentimes, when God is developing your leadership and developing you in leadership roles, it means that you're going to be the object of people's anger. But you know what? There's no leadership development if you've never experienced hardship. Right, Jason? If you've never had a difficult time running a business and experiencing hardship, you're not being developed as a leader. David Jeremiah, I think it was David Jeremiah, many, many years ago, I heard him on the radio. He said that Christian maturity is moving from a soft shell and a hard heart to a hard shell and a soft heart. Christian maturity is moving from a soft shell where everything that comes at you hurts, it penetrates, it gets to your core, and you end up developing a really hard heart as a result. A heart that's cold, it's not open, doesn't want to be graceful, and it's scarred. But Christian maturity is moving from that to a hard shell where stuff just bounces off you. Let the enemy throw those flaming arrows. Let people accuse you of things that aren't true. Who cares? But you have a soft heart and you have a gracious heart for the people that God wants you to lead. The second thing that we see here, in terms of God's continued development of Moses as a leader, and this might be the single characteristic that we most see exemplified in Scripture of Moses. As God's leader, Moses will be the intercessor of God's people. As God's leader, Moses will be the intercessor of God's people. This is why we refer to Moses as a type of Christ. Our ultimate intercessor is Jesus Christ himself, who allows us access to the Father directly, who allows us access to the throne room with our prayers, our petitions. Moses is the one who goes before the Lord and asks, what shall I do with this people? Moses is the one whom God gave the instructions for the bitter waters at Marah and the quail and the manna. Moses is the one whom God instructs to take the elders and go strike the rock. Moses is the one who is standing on the mountain, completely exhausted. Exhausted to the point where he can't hold his hands up, can't stand up, all for his people. Moses is the one that God calls to intercede on behalf of the people who want to stone him. When God is calling us to intercede on behalf of others, it's often for those who aren't easy to love. When God is calling us to intercede on behalf of others, it's often those who are not easy to love. The ultimate act of intercession happened at the cross. Jesus hanging there for you and me and for the people hurling the insults at him down below says, "Forgive them, they know not what they do." That is the ultimate example of intercession. Stephen, as he's being stoned to death, looks up to heaven, sees Jesus Christ standing to welcome him and says to God, "Forgive these people for their actions who are stoning me to death. They don't know what they do." When God calls you into leadership and is developing you as a leader, you're going to be called to intercede for people who are not really very lovable on the outside. If you've got a hard shell, you can take the insults, and if you've got a soft heart, you can love them when they are otherwise unlovable, as the world says. The third thing we're going to see here, as God is developing leadership in Moses, is that Moses is going to be the delegator of God's people. As God's leader, Moses will be the delegator of God's people. Verse 6, God instructs Moses to go gather the elders of Israel. Verse 9, Moses instructs Joshua to go choose men to fight the Amalekites. And so I said in a couple of weeks, what we're going to see is Jethro coming and instructing Moses, "Look, you cannot do this all yourself. Here's what you need to do, Moses. You need to delegate." This means finding others who show themselves approved and give them some authority. And so for us, I'll speak personally, this might be my hardest one. To be honest, I think this is probably the hardest one for me personally. When God is developing us as a leader, He expects us to trust Him by trusting others. When He's developing us as a leader, He expects us to trust Him by trusting others. People don't always do stuff perfectly like you will. Amen? You know that you're going to do whatever it is and you're going to do it perfectly. And you know that if you delegate that to somebody else, chances are they're going to screw it up, right? No. Choose the person who is worthy and let go. Choose the persons who have shown themselves approved, who have shown themselves worthy, like Joshua and like the men that Joshua goes and chooses. Okay? And trust God. And they may screw it up a little bit. But God's big enough. I mean, I don't know how He sits back there at all and listens to me when I'm up here, to be honest. But He does. He sits back and says, "I'll let Him handle some here and there." Crazy. Ridiculous. Look at Numbers chapter 27, and we're almost done. Numbers chapter 27. Numbers chapter 27, we'll begin in verse 15. Verse 15, "Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation. Who will go out and come in before them? Who will lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd?' So the Lord said to Moses, 'Take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. And have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and commission him in their sight. And you shall put some of your authority on him, in order that all the congregation of the sons of Israel may obey him. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and the sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. And look at verse 22. And Moses did just as the Lord commanded him. And he took Joshua and set him before Eleazar, the priest, and before all the congregation. Then he laid his hands on him and commissioned him just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. What a great example. Turn back to chapter 17. What a great example of delegation. Moses said, my days are numbered. These people are going to need a leader. These people are going to need somebody to take them in and out of the promised land, to go before them, who's trustworthy, who has the Spirit upon him. Joshua was God's succession plan for Israel to enter the promised land. Fortunately, you all have a succession plan here. Michael's getting extremely old. He won't be with us forever. I will take you into the promised land, okay? Hey, stick with me, and I'll get us through this, okay? Okay. Last point. As God's leader, Moses will be the scribe of God's people. As God is developing Moses as a leader, he will be the scribe of God's people. Maybe probably better stated that Moses will cause God to be remembered and memorialized. That's essentially what is at the heart of this, that Moses will promote or cause God to be remembered and memorialized. Verse 7, Moses named the place where Israel tested God and quarreled as Massa and Meribah, which mean test and quarrel. That's what those words mean. So, the place where this took place and this event happened, where they quarreled and tested God, Moses records, he writes, he names those places testing and quarreling. So that every Israelite who comes through in the future will remember, this is what happened here and this is what God did. Deuteronomy 6, verse 16 says, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test like you tested him at Massa. And so we also see in verses 14 through 16 here that God instructed Moses to record what God had done to Amalek and that God promised to always judge Amalek for, or the Amalekites for their sin against Israel. So not only did Moses name after testing and quarreling, but he also obeys God's command to name this place to memorialize God's victory. Isn't that interesting? He says, God says, write this in a book as a memorial. This is how future generations will know and understand the great things that God has done. He also says, recite this to Joshua. Why does Joshua need to know God's promise regarding Amalek? Because they're going to linger around for a while. They're going to be a thorn in Joshua's side when Joshua takes them into the promised land. The third thing, we see that Moses built an altar and named it. He names it, the Lord is my banner, representing the victory in the battle and holding up of his arms, hands, and possibly the staff. So I'll say this, the NET has an interesting technical note here. It says that when Israel murmurs and fails, when they murmur and fail God, the names commemorate the incident or the failure. When Israel fails God, the names commemorate the incident or the failure. Yet when Israel is blessed with success, the name praises God. And so for us, when God is developing us as leaders, he expects us to call to people's remembrance his goodness. That seems kind of obvious and silly, but God expects us to call to people's remembrance his goodness. Do the people around us in our spheres of influence see and hear us giving testimony about God regularly? Are the people around us aware of God's hand at work in our lives and theirs? Are we helping to memorialize the name of God and what he has done so that others can know? at our old house. I used to remember the projects that we did by all the lovely ladies in my life. I remember that we did the bathroom shortly after Susan and I got married. We did a bathroom remodel. When I say a bathroom remodel, we punched out the rear wall and cantilevered the bathroom out. It wasn't just like replacing some fixtures. Shortly after Sarah was born, we did a 2.5-car detached garage. And I remember the date of doing that because it was right around the time that Sayer was born, a little after. We did a kitchen remodel shortly after Rennie was born. So I remember when the kitchen remodel was done because Rennie was very young. And then Mirren, we just flat out moved. So you can tell who the favorite is. My point is this. I could walk around our old house and I could tell you when things were done because they essentially had been memorialized by the people in my life. The landscape of Israel is blistered with memorials so that God's people would remember what He had done for them. We have cities named for God's victories and some of the failures. We have plateaus named. We have Ebenezers that are raised. That's one of Susan's favorite words, Ebenezers. Ebenezers are those erections that God's people would create to memorialize something that God had done for them. You know, Jacob makes an altar at Bethel where he's at on the run from Esau. We have Abraham setting up altars and worshiping God. We have all of the patriarchs who traveled through the promised land and establishing these memorial moments because of God's goodness. Because of God's faithfulness. And those serve as reminders for God's people. And so we are called to do the same. How do future generations know how good God is, how faithful God is, if we are not sharing, if we are not writing things down, if we are not memorializing what God has done in our lives? They won't know. And so as we finish this, we'll say today, our grumbling has similar roots, whether we want to acknowledge that or not. Our grumbling says that we don't believe that God is able to care for our every need. Essentially. Our grumbling is often toward another human entity because it's easy and it's satisfying to put a face on our frustration. But we need to remember what we're ultimately saying. And at the same time as we're being convicted of maybe about our grumbling and our complaining, God is also developing leadership qualities in each of us. And the irony is, as leaders, there will be people who grumble against you. But that's okay. That's how God grows you into the person that He needs you to be. To love others, to intercede for others, to help delegate. Amen.